Okay, so the title of my presentation is Immigrant Trans Latinas in New York City, Resiliencies, Vulnerabilities, and Health Disparities. So it was done through Beth Israel Medical Center, the Edbaron Edmund Leigh Rothschild Chemical Dependency Institute at Beth Israel Medical Center. And we'd like to thank all participants in the studies, the coordinators, harm reduction programs and staff, and our funders, New York State AIDS Institute and Keith Haring Foundation. No conflicts of interest. So immigrant trans Latinas are a highly understudied population. It actually appears that Latinas comprise the largest ethnic racial group of trans women in the New York City metropolitan area. The vast majority of Latinas are low-income immigrants, and many are often undocumented. And in another study that I was part of, we measured 49% HIV seroprevalence amongst trans Latinas. For this study, there were trans women focus group participants who were members of transgender support groups at 5 New York City harm reduction programs. And so we conducted 6 focus group total at these 5 harm reduction programs that were located in Queens, Bronx, Manhattan, and Brooklyn. Participation was confidential, and all names in this that I'll be presenting are pseudonyms. They were 2 hours long. They also completed a short demographic survey and auto-digitally recorded. We had codes independently, the codes were independently coded, double-coded. Spanish speakers were voluntarily translated for participants to express difficulty with English. So there were a total of 34 low-income trans people of color in this total study, and out of the 34, 21 were Latina identified, and out of the 21, 13 were recent immigrant Latinas. Basing on anecdotal evidence, it appears that about 85% of immigrant trans Latinas in New York City are undocumented, so it's a very high percentage. So for my presentation, I'm going to be looking mostly at resiliency slash support, vulnerabilities, and I'm going to, if we have time, briefly touch on some health outcomes. I can't present much of the findings. All the findings from the study. So to begin with resiliencies and support, what we found was that immigrant trans Latinas were often in social networks before the actual initiation of formal support groups, such as at AIDS Center of Queens County, and we identified 2 types of mechanisms that were operating in these support social networks that we call alternative kinship structures. One is thick trust. This is based on an article by Rastilla, which was based on bonding, emotional sharing, connection, and intimacies. And then the other component was thin trust, information dissemination, sharing of resources across disparate groups. And so we actually found that kind of the interface of thick trust and thin trust was really what made both the alternative kinship structures and when they did formally organize into support groups at the harm reduction programs, highly successful. And so this is a quote, and I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I'll just summarize. Basically, the interview asked how Alaska had met Jovanka, and what had happened was that 6 to 7 years ago, there was another trans Latina named Vanessa, and she would inject all the trans Latinas in these particular neighborhoods in Queens with hormones. And so in Mexico and other countries, when a doctor gives you a prescription, they actually have someone who does the injections. And so that was Vanessa's role. And it's very interesting because, this is not injection drug use, but for those of you who have any experience doing injection drug use studies, oftentimes there's similar roles that take place. Like you have people, the hit doctor and the runner and all this stuff. So anyway, Vanessa was the injector, and then at that time she was roommates with Alaska, and so that's how Alaska met Jovanka. And so when Jovanka formally created the support group that was in part of ACQC, she invited Alaska, and Alaska has been attending continuously for the last few years. And then what Jovanka would do is her role was to come and provide the needles and then take the used needles. So they would, you know, this would be in 2008, they would gather in someone's apartment in Queens, over 100 trans-Latinas would show up, and they would all congregate there for 30, 45 minutes and, you know, get injected with hormones. And this was a totally informally based out of the alternative kinship structure. And out of so many trans-Latinas coming, they realized that they should create a formal support group. And so I think this is really beautiful because it shows a kind of more grassroots organizing versus a kind of top-down model that I think is really prevalent in public health. Now, resiliency within support group, so once they did provide the, create the formal support group structure, then there was a lot, they could really expand on counseling advocacy, legal services, health and medical service information, and also networking, connecting with other Latina trans women support groups, because the ones that we interviewed were only in conjunction with harm reduction programs, and there's also immigrant trans Latina support groups that are affiliated with community centers, for instance, or, you know, that Queens has an LGBT center. So it's really important that they also start to increase their networks that way. So these are just don't get hung up on the numbers. This is just our internal coding. But we had identified some ways that they were, that within the support group, they received support for gender transition. And so, you know, for instance, 1.2.4 is interesting because through being involved in support group, they were able to start to access and create support systems outside of the support group around their gender transition. And it also increased 1.2.6 self-reliance and creating allies with cisgendered Latinas, and just increased trust, along with more pragmatic issues like name change, et cetera. In terms of social educational support, a lot of the trans Latinas were able from participating in support groups to, for instance, finish their high school degrees, get a GED. Many of them had not graduated high school. And then also plans for the future, kind of for them to discuss how do they want to create their lives for the future besides just focusing on day-to-day survival. If they had housing issues, finding stable housing for them, et cetera. Now, in terms of vulnerabilities, the number of vulnerabilities, unfortunately, are greater than the number of resiliencies, but I don't want to then connote that the resiliencies are less or have less of an impact. You know, there's just less number of them that we have identified so far. So in terms of vulnerabilities, there were many forms. They were often intersecting and interlocking, and there was social support network exclusion and family exclusion, housing, employment, healthcare exclusion, discrimination, along with many forms of violence and victimization, and legal exclusion and discrimination. So we had coded some themes around family in general, and it was really interesting because these themes run just biological family relations then really intersected with when we looked at family and housing exclusion. And this was a common pattern among immigrant trans Latinas because oftentimes they were living with their families, and then they would get ostracized, and so then they both had no familial support or had housing at the same time. So an example is Alaska, who was kicked out of her house when she was six. And actually, when we interrogated her further, she actually wasn't kicked out. Her family identified her as being gay or feminine when she was six, and they were trying to force her to go get psychological treatment so she could cure her gayness. And so she left out of her own accord because she didn't want to bring shame to the family. And then she lived with some transgender friends, and she started doing sex work at age of 11. And she's uncommon because she actually came from a middle-class family, and most of the immigrant trans Latinas that we interviewed come from poverty-class rural areas. But the same phenomenon of being kicked out and then, you know, kind of being on your own or leaving because you don't want to cause shame to your family was very prevalent with the other Latinas that we interviewed. In terms of employment exclusion, there are multiple vulnerabilities. Now, there's a lot of research that shows that already being a trans woman, you know, just a citizen like, let's just say like a white American U.S. citizen trans woman is already, you know, there's already a vulnerability around employment. But then if we then, you know, start to intersect the vectors of being Latina and immigrant and undocumented, right, and maybe not knowing the English language very well, you can imagine that that's going to be probably nearly impossible to find employment. So we found that there were many issues around employment. You know, some even would have periods of reverse transitioning and presenting as male so that they could find work as at least undocumented immigrant, you know, male Latinos. And but then those, you know, but if they really, you know, if they wanted to present full-time as women, oftentimes it was sex work was really their only option. Okay, and then in terms of medical and mental health services, there was a lot of issues, especially lack of access to health services, and in particular the underground economy medical access. And this was very interesting because what we found was that with the underground medical economy, there was an active underground medical economy around hormones and hormones administration and silicone injection administration. And these would operate through the alternative kinship social networks. And so what we found was that even when sometimes the trans Latinas could have access to legal forms that are considered, that we would consider safer, they would still choose to go through the underground economy because of, I think, that idea of thick trust, right, which is, I think, provides an emotional and psychological safety for them than going to, you know, somewhere with people they don't know. So I think this is something really important when we talk about, like, healthcare access, especially to our most marginalized trans and gender variant populations. In terms of barrier to healthcare access, this is a really interesting quote. Janice is talking about, you know, she talks about how the trans Latinas are from like lower income rural areas. She said, you know, she calls it they don't have the sophistication for relationships. I call it the peasant mentality. And she says a lot of times the caseworkers take the trans women for granted, and they'll just give the trans Latinas, you know, here's this number, just call it. But the trans Latinas don't do the calling. They're not the calling type because this is not what they're used to. And so Janice states that they need really a lot of directions, you know. You know, like if you tell them where the doctor is and they go over there, they see a lot of white people, they think, oh, I don't belong here. They made a mistake or they're going to discriminate against me. She also talks about how, you know, even navigating the subway system in New York City is very, very daunting. And a lot of times they won't go on the subway into Manhattan if they live in Queens. So there's a lot of issues that I feel like the present purview of our medical health system does not see and recognize and address. You know, so I think this is very important to identify these things. In terms of victimization, it was very common on all social levels, and but you know, they say that it was worse in their countries of origin, and that's why they come here. Even being undocumented immigrants, they say they would suffer more violence being citizens in their Latin American countries of origin. If they were incarcerated, which oftentimes they were, because, you know, not only like, you know, they may be incarcerated for sex work, but there were times that oftentimes they would be accused of acts that they did not do. So, for instance, one trans Latina told us that she was actually assaulted by a man on a street. And then when the police came, because she did not know English well or her rights, the man actually accused her of attacking him. And then she got put into, in Rikers for 18 months. And so, you know, it's just issues like this that happen all the time. And so even when she was first put into an LGBT-specific facility at Rikers, she was getting physically abused. Oh, she was getting sexually abused by the jail workers there. And the jail workers were abusing a lot of the inmates. And then... and then they transferred. I think they closed that facility down. I don't know if it was temporarily or permanently. And then they transferred all the trans Latinas into the male prison side. And so Janice was being sarcastic, and she said, oh, yeah, so then they can abuse her better. And she said, that logic doesn't make any sense to me. And so she said she spent a year and a half in jail. It was completely humiliating. She tried to take her life twice. Among trans Latinas, they make a joke that if you're incarcerated, you're on vacation. So this is something that she mentions. And, there was tremendous amounts of verbal and physical abuse. And Jovanka said that Alaska would call her 2-3 times a week, and then, the male inmates fractured Alaska's nose. She needs surgery. She has a fracture. She has not been able to access surgery, and, you know, it still hurts her. So there's tremendous amounts of violence. All right, so in terms of immigration, so this, of course, incarceration really intersects with immigration issues. And, you know, something that I think people on the legal side are really starting to look at is how to see, support the case for immigrant trans Latinas as being here for, as asylum, you know. This is really about seeking asylum because of the immense threats they experience in their home countries. And also, some trans Latinas were also victims of human trafficking. So, this is something also that I think we should pay attention to. And that, you know, they're not just coming here for a better economic opportunity. Since 9/11, there have been a lot of deportations too. So the health outcomes, you can ask me during the Q&A. There was some interesting issues around health outcomes I can talk further about, but my time is out. So I'm just going to go to conclusion, which is that basically they're highly vulnerable and victimized, yet they're highly resilient also. And I think it's really important for us to identify, implement, and operationalize this resilience even further. And that, you know, there's really a need for interconnected services, as well as expanding and strengthening their alternative kinship structures. And I think just looking at undocumented immigrant trans Latinas as a case study is really interesting for us to challenge our current purview of the medical health systems and nonprofit agencies. Thank you.